Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest on Better Than I Found It is Emmanuel University head men's golf coach Logan Reese. Now, Logan is only 25 years old and was probably the youngest head coach in all of college golf 2 years ago when he was hired. We talk about the pride he feels in leading a team at his alma mater, but also the challenges of coaching some players who were actually teammates of his during his time at Emmanuel. We discuss his strong faith in Jesus Christ and how he has used that to overcome many obstacles. Logan may be young, but he seems to have experience well beyond his years. Enjoy the listening. Okay, Better Than I Found It listeners, welcome Logan Reese, the men's golf coach at Emmanuel University, to the podcast today. Logan, appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your busy spring schedule. I know how busy it is this time of year, but just thanks for taking time to join me today.
Coach, thank you so much. I'm really honored to be a part of this, and I was super excited to get the invitation, and I'm super happy to be talking to you today.
Well, you know, I had the idea of seeing you by Zoom call the last several months as we've been on this Thursday morning Bible study with Corky Kemp. And I thought to myself, you know, I haven't had a smaller school head coach on here in a while. It's been a little while. And I thought, you know what, with the way things are changing in collegiate athletics, the way the challenges are that every coach is facing at every level, it'd be nice to hear from a Division II coach, you know, just kind of where things are with you. So I thought you'd be a great plus. You're one of the youngest coaches in college golf, so I wanted to hear about that too.
Well, it's funny. I was actually texting you something about your podcast a couple of weeks ago, and just telling you how much I loved it. And I almost made the joke, if you're ever desperate for a guest, I would love to be on. But it's funny. I didn't even say it. I always imagined coming on the podcast and you interviewing me, but I didn't think I was quite qualified yet. But when I got your text that you wanted to have me on, I was super excited and honored that. I guess I have a couple qualifications to get on. You know, I'm a lot less qualified than most of your phenomenal guests, but I'm super excited and hope I can bring some fun stuff to the table.
Well, I appreciate you being excited about that. But there's one thing that I tell young coaches all the time, and I really mean this. I don't just say it. You're probably better in some aspects of coaching than I am. I may have 36 years of experience, but that's what I've got on you is the experience. Who knows what else I have on you, but you may do some things better than I do right now. And that's what you need to discover is things that you do really, really well that you don't even know are good. And that's why I like talking to young coaches, because I really think they've got things to offer. You've got fresh new ideas. So how are you better than I am, Logan? I want to know.
Well, I don't think I can say I'm better than you at all, but I will say, Being close to this generation and essentially coaching my own generation, I do feel that I connect well with the guys. I understand and relate to them. And obviously I'm not saying that you don't, but just being from different generations, I feel like I see eye to eye to them on a lot of things and am able to build some great relationships with the guys. So maybe that's one little thing.
Yeah, you understand a little bit better what they're going through than I do. I see it every day. I'm with them every day, but I also don't really come from their perspective. You listen to the same music, or you have listened to the same music. You have had the same influences. I haven't had those influences. They were different when I was your age. So I love getting that perspective. So appreciate you doing this.
Well, I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let's talk about your spring schedule. I know you've played a couple of events already. And so tell me about the team's progress and then your upcoming schedule as well.
Yes, sir. So we've played a couple of times already. We played at Caledonia Golf and Fish Club. That was hosted by Barton. Great D2 event. We didn't play great, but definitely learned a few things. And one of our guys played pretty well, one of our seniors. And then the week after, this past week, we played Landers tournament at Greenwood Country Club in Greenwood, South Carolina. So both tournaments, our finishes on paper weren't great, but they were two tremendous fields. And if you consider if you go back before last year, both of our scores would have been program records. So we're definitely headed in the right direction. And it's great to see a couple of the guys playing well. One of our freshmen played great at this tournament last week. Jack Garcia, he finished 2 under for the tournament. So definitely some positives. You know, seniors will play well 1 week, freshmen will play well the next week. So one of these days, they're all going to play to get great on the same day, and we're going to go low.
That would be great to hear. Just give me the makeup of your team. Tell me, if you would, the names and the places they're from on your team, from seniors down to freshmen.
Yeah, so in our lineup, we've got 2 seniors, 2 freshmen, and a sophomore. So both of our seniors are from Spain, Pelayo Sol and Markel Olasagasti. So Markel's from the Basque Country, where John Rahm is from. And then Pelayo is from the north of Spain, kind of a more mountainous area, but also kind of by the ocean. And so they've been here all 4 years and really developed as players. And I've been super proud to see their growth. Markel was second team all conference last year, and he's really a great player. Pelayo has just gotten better every year. And so they're definitely 2 leaders on the team. They lead by example. They're on time to practice and workouts and always showing up for everything. Our sophomore, his name is Daniel Alonso Dreljevic. He's from Spain as well. So we got 3 Spaniards in the lineup at the moment. And Danny, he's a heck of a ball striker. He's got all the shots, and he hits a beautiful stinger. He can really flight the ball down. And really, we've got some great ball strikers all around on the team. And the tougher conditions get, the more excited I get, because I know my guys can play in the wind. So I almost prefer them on a difficult course in tough conditions than on an easier course in a shootout, because I know they're gonna fight and hang in there. And then our 2 freshmen, Jack Garcia, he's from Alpharetta, Georgia. He's got a heck of a ceiling, and he's already shown it, putting up some good scores in tournaments. He's shot a couple of rounds in the 60s this year. And so he's been a bit inconsistent, but he's shown that ceiling, and I know he's a great player. He's a heck of a ball striker. He hit 17 greens in the last round of our last tournament. I think he hit 86% of greens over the course of the whole tournament. And then our other freshman, Austin Spencer, he's from the Athens, Georgia area. And he is a grinder. I mean, I'm fortunate to have a few grinders on the team, but Austin's someone that works his butt off each and every day. And him and Jack are both early birds. So they take after you in that aspect. They're never afraid of the early, you know, 6 a.m., 6:30 workouts. They're always early to those, putting in work in the gym. And so I'm super excited. Both those freshmen have all kinds of upside, and they've already shown some good scores. So it's looking good.
That's like a good mix. I've coached 1 Spaniard. His name was Pablo Martin at Oklahoma State. And I think he's the closest thing to Seve Ballesteros that I ever coached. And he had a lot of fire. Do your Spaniards have some fire in them?
Oh, they definitely have a little bit of fire. Definitely a little bit of fire. You know, sometimes I'm trying to rein them in a bit, but sometimes it's just learning to sit back and let them let out a little bit. It's finding that balance, you know, trying to rein them in, but also letting them have that passion and that drive. So it's always a little back and forth.
Definitely was with Pablo, and he was just the best player in the country. And he would get excitable sometimes. It spilled over into emotionalism occasionally, but he was a fun guy to coach. So that must be really interesting with 3 Spaniards. You got a relatively late start to the game, freshman year in high school. That's late to start golf, competitively for sure. What kind of benefited you most in your early development? Like, how did you develop? What sped up your improvement? How did you get to a college golf team when you took up the game as a freshman in high school?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So it was freshman year of high school. I was actually homeschooled in high school, and I'd missed basketball tryouts and just saw a flyer for golf lessons actually at the George Bryan Golf Academy in South Carolina. And it was a guy by the name of Chase Baller.
My good buddy George, I love him.
Oh man, George is awesome. I've stayed in touch with him to this day. He's the best. And so there's a guy that worked for him by the name of Chase Butler, and he was doing group lessons for kids once a week. And talked to my parents. They thought, you know, golf's a great sport, whether or not you do anything with it. It's great in the business world. It's just something that a lot of people play. So I tried it out and I got obsessed. And then Chase told me and my brother about this homeschool golf team. So I was living in Columbia, South Carolina at the time. There was a homeschool golf team that played all the local high schools. So we joined the team. And so that was January of my freshman year and tried out for the team. I think I shot 57 in tryouts and for 9 holes. And but they let me on the team, and then I found out that being on the team let me play for free at Lindrick Golf Club in Columbia, a little muni. And my mom, obviously I didn't have a driver's license yet, my mom was nice enough to drive me out there. And I have a pretty obsessive personality, and once I started playing golf, I just got obsessed. And I was always at Lindrick, they let us play for free, but we had to pay for range balls, and I was always too cheap to buy range balls. So I would chip and putt for hours, and then I'd go play. And so I feel like, obviously, in this day and age, being a ball striker is super important, but I really learned the basics first, chipping and putting and learning how to score and being out on the golf course. And thanks to my mom taking me to the course every day and me just becoming obsessed with the game, I would just spend hours out there every day. And then Chase Butler and George Bryan did a ton to help us out. They would give us lessons a couple days a week at a discounted rate for my brother and I, picking up balls out at their place. And so we would be picking up balls, and they'd let us practice there all we wanted to. And man, they have a great little facility out in the woods. And now they're building a whole new academy, so I'm excited to see that. But I just spent hours out there and playing Lindrick Golf Course. And that, the first half of my first semester of high school, I averaged 57 for 9 holes in practicing matches. And then the second half, averaged 49. And then sophomore year, averaged 46 the first half, 42 the second half. And then junior year, we moved down to Daytona Beach, Florida. So I spent my last couple years in Daytona. Junior year, I think I averaged 41 for 9 holes. And then senior year, averaged 39 for 9-hole matches. So I kept coming down more and more, but it was really just that obsession. I just love the game. I didn't even think I would have a chance of playing in college. I thought I got into it too late. I was really just doing it because I loved it and I was obsessed, and I just wanted to get better.
You keep using the word obsessed. I was obsessed with golf as a kid, and I probably became obsessed with coaching when I became a coach. Are you obsessed with your coaching world too?
Oh yeah, I love it. I love it. And it's definitely, you know, when I first started coaching, I missed playing so much. You know, I wanted to be out there playing, but pretty soon I realized that I get the exact same thrill of making a putt when one of my guys makes a putt, or winning a tournament when one of my guys wins a tournament. And so now just being able to live vicariously through them in a way and coach them. And there's really no greater feeling than standing on the green with one of your players and kind of debating a line. And then they just hit the putt exactly where you thought it should be. And then it goes in the middle, and, you know, having them pull that off, there's really no greater feeling. And I just absolutely love it. And so I'm pretty obsessed with the coaching and making us better and finding ways to get better and recruiting, finding more and more guys. And so I love it.
That's awesome. Well, I love the enthusiasm that you have, because I think that's one of the two necessities in this world of coaching, or any endeavor actually, is enthusiasm. So you love what you do, and then obviously working hard. I think a guy who's obsessed is probably going to be a pretty hard worker. So that's really good. So what advice would you give a young man? Because you just described your situation. You got into the game late. You just steadily came down with your scores. But a kid who's behind in recruiting because he got a late start, they start to panic, and their parents panic and all of that. What's the best advice you'd give, because you've been through it?
Yeah, I would say first off, you have to believe in yourself. You know, I obviously believed in myself when it came to golf, but I just didn't think, you know, I was at a point where I was capable of being on a college team. It was actually my high school golf coach down in Florida, Don Garner, he started emailing college coaches for me, because I didn't feel like I had whole lot of a resume. You know, I started winning some some smaller junior tournaments in Florida, local stuff, but I didn't feel like I had the kind of resume I needed. But my high school golf coach had that self-belief. He started reaching out to a bunch of coaches for me. And that's actually how I found out about Emmanuel. The Emmanuel coach responded, and you know, huge shout out to Coach Garner for putting in a kind word for me and telling him what a hard worker I was. And so I'd say, first of all, you got to believe in yourself and have people around you that believe in you. Also, my high school coach in South Carolina, Lee Winters, he would always tell us, you know, being a homeschool team, we all lived kind of far from the course. We only had team practice once a week. But his philosophy was, we can only meet as a team once a week, but I want each of you guys to do something to get better at golf 15 minutes a day. And I really took that to heart. And I thought about that for years. So even on days I couldn't make it to the course or there was really bad weather, I would chip in the living room with wiffle balls, or I would be on a putting mat working on my putting stroke or reading a book about golf psychology. I really took what Coach Winter said, just do something every single day. And so I would say the most important thing is to love it, because you know how golf is. It's going to beat you up. You're not always going to get results. And there's so many different aspects of the game that you really have to put a lot of time in to get good at golf. And if you don't love it, then you're not going to enjoy the process. Cause really that's what it's all about in the end. If you can't enjoy the process, then why are you even doing it?
Do you make that a goal of yours to try to help your players continue to enjoy the game? Because that's literally one of the three goals I have for my players, is they are going to love the game as much after they play for me as they did before they played for me.
Yeah, that's what I tell the guys on the team. That's what I tell recruits. I'm like, look, at the end of the day, golf is a sport. It's a game. You know, we're not here to make ourselves miserable. The whole point is to have fun. You know, my little joke or caveat is that the easiest way to have fun is to win, but we got to have fun all along the way. And the whole point of the game is to have fun. So if you're not going to have fun, then really, what's the point of doing it?
I agree. Yeah. Some of the players that I've coached that have been the best players had the most fun doing it. And so I think it goes hand in hand. Not many people get to coach at their alma mater. So you're coaching where you played college golf, and there must be some pressure, excitement, pride, all of that. Tell me about that feeling of being the head coach. I mean, first of all, you're a young head coach, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, but the pride that you have, the excitement of coaching at Emmanuel.
Yeah, I was super excited to get this opportunity. You know, I told our athletic director, Nate Mormon, I just wanted a shot. And as soon as, you know, it became public that our previous head coach was retiring, I told him that I just wanted a chance. He said he couldn't promise me the job, but he would give me an interview. And so I'm really thankful to Nate and our whole athletic department for taking a shot on me. And I'm really proud to be the coach at Emmanuel. It's a great place. There's so many phenomenal people there. And I really think that was an advantage too. With being such a young guy and obviously not having much of a coaching resume at all yet, it would have been really tough for me to go out and get a job somewhere else. But being at Emmanuel, knowing all the people in the athletic department, knowing professors, just knowing how everything works at Emmanuel was really a big advantage and made that transition a lot smoother. And I'm fortunate there's so many great resources at Emmanuel. We have some phenomenal coaches, you know, guys that really are overqualified to be at a little Division II school, but just love the culture and love the people at Emmanuel. And so I've really taken advantage of that. And I try to talk to other coaches there, and I'm proud to be a Lion and hoping to bring us some titles someday.
Well, I think that's great. I think that I've known coaches who coaching at their alma mater. One thing they can speak to is when they talk to a recruit or a recruit's parents, they can really talk about what this school has done for me, you know, what it did for my development as a person, that type of thing. So I know you're probably excited to be able to speak to that for sure. You were also a great student in college, really made a high GPA. You were really good. A lot of kids think it's hard to combine school and golf, their sport, with academics, but I think they go hand in hand. I think excellence in one area bleeds over into the other. How do you use your ability to have been a good student to inspire your players to do the same?
Yeah, so I always enjoyed, I always felt some gratification making good grades. And the thing that I loved about school is unlike golf at times, there's often a direct correlation between the amount of work you put in and the result you get. And that's what I tell the guys. I tell the guys, you can go practice for hours, but go out and shoot 80. That's just the reality of golf. But if you put in time for your schoolwork, if you work hard, you're going to see results. So that's something that I always enjoyed. It was really a direct result of the amount of work put in was the grade I got put out. And so that's what I tell the guys. Really, there's no excuses. Obviously, everyone has different natural levels of intelligence, but we can make up for it. And no matter your intelligence level, if you're willing to work hard and you're able to get into college, then you can pass all the classes and you can make good grades. And so I tell the guys, there's really no excuse. You just have to put the work in. And when it comes to being a student athlete and playing golf, it's obviously it's a big topic thrown around, but time management, everyone talks about it, but it really is key. I was somehow able to work a job, be in the school choir, be on the golf team, and still make decent grades. So I kind of tell the guys, you know, you can come up with excuses, but I'm pretty sure if I could pull it off, then you guys can pull it off. So I don't want to hear any excuses.
So you were in the choir as well. What couldn't you do? Can you sing for me right now?
Oh, no. I'm not a soloist. I'm a pitch matching back of the bleachers kind of guy.
Well, that's okay. That's all right. But you got a lot of talents. That's great. Well, you know, Logan, you became a head coach at age 23. It's not unprecedented. There's been coaches through the years. I'll just name two real quick. Mike Holder, who I worked for at Oklahoma State, took the job. He was the second coach at Oklahoma State at age 24. He had gotten his master's at Oklahoma State and was going to turn professional. He took the job just kind of as a thing to do for a year or two and then became the greatest college golf coach in history. Jay Mosley, who's now the golf coach at Ohio State, started at Kennesaw State at age 24. So to be a coach at 23 is unusual, not unprecedented, but it's really interesting because, one, I know you were coaching guys that were on the team. So teammates, former teammates. Talk about that dynamic. What were the biggest hurdles you faced drawing a line between player and coach, which isn't easy? How did you earn their respect, their trust? I'm going to ask a bunch of questions relative to this, but 23, a head coach, I could not have done it. I promise you.
Well, it's crazy. So four of the guys that are seniors on the team right now, we're on the team when I was a player. We've got one fifth year guy that was here even when I was a junior. And then three of our seniors were here my freshman year. And so I was definitely a bit nervous when I took the job because we had been buddies. We were friends. I was nervous that they might not respect me or listen to what I had to say. But I would say I was honestly pleasantly surprised. The transition was easier than I expected. And I give the guys full credit for that. They were all willing to respect me and listen to me. And obviously there's still things that can be difficult, but they really bought in and were really willing to listen to what I had to say and go with whatever I say. And I really appreciate that. And I think a big reason for that is because I was always honest with them and upfront. I didn't, as soon as I became coach, I didn't suddenly pretend that I had all the answers, that I knew everything. I told them, I was like, guys, like, I don't have much experience. It's not like I really know what I'm doing, but I promise you everything that I do and everything I have you do is because I think it's for the best of the team. Like, I'm not just making this stuff up. And I told them about conversations that I had with other coaches, you know, for some weird qualifying rules, I would just blame you. I'd be like, hey, they do this at a big D1 school. And, you know, I took a lot of weird qualifying ideas from your book better than I found it. And, you know, some of the guys don't love all the strange formats, but I would just say, hey, look, they do this at a big D1 school. So if you have a problem with that, then I don't know what your issue is. And so
you don't have all the answers, and I don't either. So trust me. You're not going to have them for years. But the fact that you had the courage to jump out there and do some unusual things, that took a lot of courage right there.
Well, thank you. And full credit to them for really taking a shot and believing in me. And we've always had open communication. I always tell them, I'm like, look, if you don't agree with something I'm doing, just you're welcome to come to my office anytime and meet with me. And a lot of guys have taken me up on it. They'll say, you know, hey coach, can I come talk to you? And they'll explain their point of view. And if I think they're right, then, you know, I'm not too hard headed to adjust what I said, but if I think I'm right, then I'm not afraid to stand up for them.
What was their least favorite qualifying technique that you got from my book?
Oh, definitely reducing the clubs. So I haven't even done, sometimes we'll play in practice 3 clubs and a putter, but we haven't, I want to do that for a qualifier. I haven't quite done it, but we would do like 7 club qualifiers or odd irons only or even irons only. And, you know, some guys on the team just aren't a fan of the format. But the funny thing to me is that, you know, this year I haven't played around with as many formats and regrettably so. I think it's fun. Next year I'm definitely going to get back to some of that stuff. But last year I did all kinds of stuff. But no matter what the conditions were, the format, our top guys would always finish at the top, and the lineup was usually the same regardless of the format. So at the end of the day, that's kind of what I told them. Like, look, all these things are just exposing who the best players really are, and that's kind of the point of qualifying.
I agree with that. And the one thing I like about doing different formats is they don't know what to expect sometimes, and they're uncomfortable. And I always tell them, guys, you're upset at me because this is uncomfortable and it's not normal and you're not used to this. Well, that's going to happen every single competitive round you play the rest of your life. So do you want me to help you get prepared for that? Or do you just want me to make you feel good here in Waco, Texas? Because the last time I checked, it's not always comfortable on the road.
Fair enough. Fair point. Yeah, I remember one time I did a surprise qualifier as well at practice one day. I was like, all right, teeing off in 10 minutes, hit a couple balls if you want. But they definitely weren't a fan of that either. But I told them, like, you never know what's going to happen. Unexpected things happen at tournaments, and you always got to be ready to compete.
I agree. So Emmanuel is a relatively small school. I said relatively. It's got less than 1,000 students. A lot of high schools are bigger than that. I mean, tons of high schools. And you've transitioned to Division II in the last 5 or 6 years. So tell me about that, because you were transitioning, I think, when you were in college, correct? And then you obviously, there's some challenges being a small school, Division II school. Talk about that.
Yes, sir. So it was my sophomore year, 2018-19 was when we got full status. We were NAIA before, and around 2013, 2014, we started the transition up to Division II. The NCAA has about a 4-year provisional period. So it was 2018, 2019 when we got full Division II status. And as a university, we have 18 or maybe 19 now conference championships. So we've seen a lot of success. Our swim team is phenomenal. Our swim team alone has I believe 7 conference championships between the men and the women. Our men's basketball team has won 2 conference championships, and they're playing tomorrow in the championship for a chance at a third title. And we have the leading point scorer in men's basketball in the country, KJ Jones. He's averaging 26 a game. So he's a phenomenal player. And really he's a testament to the Emmanuel culture, because these days, you know how it is with the portal, guys up and leave all the time. KJ has been a phenomenal player, 2- or 3-time All-American, and he could have gone and made a bunch of NIL money this year. And the coaches understood. They said that they basically gave him their blessing if he wanted to go make a bunch of money. But he said that he wasn't in it for the money. He was in it for the love, and he wanted to commit to us and stay with us. So he came back here for his senior year this year and has continued to lead the team. And now we're nationally ranked in basketball and playing for a conference title tomorrow. So hopefully they can make a little run at regional soon. But I'm super proud of what our athletic department has done and the phenomenal coaches that we have that have led us to quite a bit of success.
Well, you know, on that note, I haven't delved too much into the transfer portal, but I have a few opinions on it. One is that it's crazy that the player himself can not deal with the coach. He can just put his name in the portal and just be gone. And I have a problem with that. I think that's not teaching conflict resolution. If a player on my team has a problem with me, he should come talk to me and we can work it out. But so I think there should be a meeting between the player, the coach, player's parents can be there, and an administrator. It would be an easy setup. Okay, can we talk through this? No, sir, I'm ready to leave. Okay, well, we made it work, or didn't make it work, whatever. If they don't have that. Number two is, let's say that you get a really good young player who kind of went under the radar, and you develop him for 2 years, and he's a first team Division II All-American national champion in your division, more than likely somebody is going to tamper with him, and it's going to happen. He's going to leave and go to a Division I school, Power Five conference school. I think that's a crime. I think it's terrible because it's not really what college athletics should be about, and it's kind of where we are nowadays.
Yeah, and I've seen so much of that. I mean, there's three schools within an hour and a half of here that I know that have had great Division II golf teams, and all three of them have continuously lost players to the portal. One of them had three All-Americans last year. They're all at D1s now. Another's had an All-American each of the last 3 years, and they've all left after being an All-American. And so somehow, impressively, some of these teams continue to excel in D2 despite constantly losing players like that. But it just makes it ever more difficult to build and sustain a strong Division II program. But then you see some that rarely ever lose guys. And so it makes you wonder. I think a great example of that is North Georgia, who's number one in the country in D2 right now. They have phenomenal guys, phenomenal players, a lot of depth, and All-Americans. And they tend not to lose guys to the portal, at least that I'm aware of. And I think that really speaks to the culture over there. But I would say you see it. You see it with all kinds of players, even more so with people coming from further away. The local guys and the Georgia kids tend to stay at these schools, tend to fall in love. But people that come from further away, they tend to dip out after having a good year. It's sad, but unfortunately it's becoming a reality.
I interviewed Lee Jansen a couple of years ago on this podcast, and he said one of the greatest things, he played for Florida Southern, was a Division II guy. He could have played at Florida, but he liked the coach better at the time at Florida Southern, so he played Division II golf. And somebody asked him during his career, why are you playing Division II golf? And Lee looked at the guy and said, what are you talking about? I'm just playing college golf. It's like, I'm just playing golf in college for a team, and I love it here, and I'm getting better. And why does it matter if I'm playing Division II golf? And the truth is, your player as a freshman comes in and he's not highly recruited by any Division I teams. You get him, you help him develop. He works hard. He uses all his resources and becomes an All-American at your level. What is the rationale that you helped him in your school and your situation helped him develop, and his obviously hard work using his resources, but why is it a natural step that he must go to? And when I've given this argument, people say, well, you're just holding him back. This is his chance to go to a Division I school and NIL money and blah, blah, blah. It's like, this is about improving as a human, improving as a golfer, and coming out of a four-year situation ready. There are Division II guys on tour, so it's not unprecedented. But that part bothers me a little bit. The portal has opened up the less of a chance for a guy like you to actually develop a player. I hate that. I hope you get to keep every player you got.
Well, honestly, my biggest problem with it is when it's not based on the schools themselves, but just simply the D1 name, just the idea of being D1. And no offense, there's a lot of great mid-major programs out there. No offense to them, but there's a lot of mid-major schools that aren't as good as high level Division II schools. And there are kids that could have a lot more fun playing for conference, regional, and national championships at the Division II level rather than being at a small D1 where they're really never have a chance to make it to the national tournament or lots of times even regionals. And so I think it really should be a case by case, school by school thing. And so that's really what bothers me when it's just D1 versus D2, and D2 golf is an incredibly high level these days. It blows my mind. I feel like even just since my first couple years as a player, just in the last half decade, 5-6 years, I feel like it's just gotten better every single year. I mean, our tournament last week, the teams that won, they tied for the lead at 36 under par. I mean, you shoot like 15 under par for 54 holes, and you were like in seventh place. I mean, the scores, and it's not like it was a very challenging course, but it wasn't a pitch and putt. I mean, the scores these days are just nuts, and the level is so high, and kids are going low at every level. You know, you even see it at JUCOs and NAI schools, kids out there shooting phenomenal numbers. And that's the depth of golf around the country just continues to amaze me at every level. D1, D2, D3, NAI, JUCO. There's just so many great players out there, and it's great to see the game growing and how much talent there is these days.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic as well. And truly somebody who shot, what was the individual winner last week in that tournament?
13 under. There were like four guys tied at 12 under and then one guy at 13.
Okay, so let's say the best Division I teams would have been entered. Let's say they were. Bev Rivas, there would have been some guys shoot 17, 18, 19 under par possibly. But I promise you those guys that were 13 under par in your event would have finished very high in a Division I tournament. So it's hard to compare because they're not playing the same course at the same time. But I've got to believe good golf is good golf, period. And they're playing a lot better golf. I played at Central Oklahoma 40 years ago, and the kids at Central Oklahoma are a lot better today than we were then. They just are. So it's better at every level.
Yes, sir.
So you developed your game into a pretty decent player. Do you still play? Do you still compete? Do you play with the guys?
Oh yeah, I play with the guys quite a bit. I love playing against them, compete with them. I love playing in qualifiers. You know, lots of times I'll end up missing a qualifier for one reason or another, so I don't always have a total score, but I enjoy playing qualifiers with them and seeing where I fall in the standings. And I have a tendency of just finishing second in qualifying, so it's a little bit frustrating for me. But you know, I would also be a little bit concerned if I was finishing first all the time. And it's funny because I was an okay player in college. I continued to get better quite a bit in college, but really when I started seeing jumps after college, when I got into coaching, and I completely stopped practicing. I mean, I would never hit balls or putt or anything, only play. 'Cause I was like, you know, I just want to do what's fun. Just want to play with the guys. And all of a sudden I just started shooting much better scores. To never think about my swing. I'm just going to go out and just play with the guys and have fun and only play target golf. And so now I stress that to the guys, you know, playing golf and not golf swing, because if you're caught up in mechanics all the time, I think that's something that really held me back my junior and senior year of college. I kind of got obsessed with my swing, and I think that's what stopped up until my sophomore year of college and then stalled out for my last couple of years. And I really think the reason was obsession with my swing. I stopped just playing golf and got obsessed with, oh, you know, my swing's not good enough to compete. I got to get better. You know, I got to get in this position. And then I graduated, took the summer off. And then when I was assistant coach that fall, I would just play with the guys in practice. And all of a sudden I start shooting much better scores. And so I really stress that to the guys now. And when it comes to competing, you know, I don't compete a whole lot, but I usually try to get in some tournament over the summer. And then there's a mini tour event I play every December down in Florida, the Riviera Open, that I believe is the longest running mini tour event in the country. I think this will be their 64th year this year, something like that. And it's a fantastic mini tour event. I used to work at the course it's at. So it's always just a great time, and they draw a great field, and they get Matt Every plays it every year. And then a handful of retired tour players. And there'll be guys from different other tours that come out. You know, sometimes you'll get some Corn Ferry guys or Latin American guys. So it's always a fantastic mini tour event. And I used to work at that course at Riviera Country Club, not to be confused with the Riviera Country Club in California, but in Ormond Beach, Florida. And that's my Masters every year. I'll start practicing about November for that in December. And that's probably the most golf I play all year.
Hopefully you get a green jacket from Riviera then one day.
Hopefully.
Well, listen, that's great that you still compete. I encourage young coaches to always still work at their game and try to remember what it's like to be working towards something like your players are. But I know your faith is very important to you. And you and I are on a Thursday morning Bible study with Corky Kemp that I mentioned earlier. And That's great. But how have you been able to use that to help your players if you've been able to do that? And talk about mission trips. I know you take some of those.
Yeah, so I'm really blessed to be at a Christian school. Emmanuel is a Christian university, and so unlike a lot of places these days, I'm allowed to talk openly about my faith, and so I definitely don't shove it down the guys' throats, but I try to live by example and lead by example. And then whenever any of them have questions, I always love talking about it. And CGF has been a huge help as well. Some of the CGF guys will come and see our team and lead by example, and we've had some great conversations. Honestly, it always seems like it's the long van rides home when you end up getting in some good deep conversations, 4 hours into a drive home, sitting in a van at 10 p.m. at night. But I always love having those conversations with the guys and seeing where they're at, and sharing my testimony and why my faith is important to me. And then you mentioned mission trips. I love being able to go on trips to other countries and share the love of Jesus and help people out. So there's an organization called Sport Exchange that I've been on a handful of trips with. Our beach volleyball coach is also the president of that mission organization. So I've gotten close with him over my time at Emmanuel, and I've gone down to Panama 3 times now. And so we've done all kinds of fun stuff in Panama. I've gotten to go all over the country, going to different people groups, different indigenous people, and doing VBS type activities with the kids and different stuff with the adults, holding services and supporting local churches. There's a lot of small churches that need the support because they're kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And so we'll go out and support them and cook a meal with them, eat with them, and invite all kinds of people from the community to come in and eat with us. And so it's been fantastic. I love that organization, and I really have a heart for Panama and Latin culture, and it's wonderful. And so it's fun having the Spaniards on the team as well, because I can work on my Spanish a bit. So I'm always listening to Spanish from Spain and the Central and South American Spanish, very different dialects, but it's still great. And some people say my accent sounds good in Spanish, and I say, oh, it's because the guys on the team always make fun of me when I say something wrong. So, the few words I can say, I better be saying them right, or so it's
That
always fun.
is great. So glad to hear that. It's wonderful. I know that that's probably driving a lot of what you do as a coach, which is great. So before we finish, I want to do a speed round with you. I haven't prepared you for the usually just kind of some fun questions. So are you ready?
I guess so. Ready or not, here
Okay.
we go.
Okay. Here we go. All right. Go to meal at a tournament, Chipotle or Chick-fil-A?
Oh, that's a tough one. Personally, I would say Chipotle. I feel like the team prefers Chick-fil-A, so usually we take the team to Chick-fil-A, but personally, I would say Chipotle.
Okay. Favorite sports movie of all time?
Favorite sports movie? Oh man, that's a good one. I feel like it's probably stereotypical for golf, but I'll just go with Caddyshack.
Wow. That was in my generation, by the way. You guys in your generation have not produced one like that. George Strait or Luke Bryan?
I you're probably gonna hate me for this, but it's my generation. I gotta say Luke Bryan. I grew up on him, and so I gotta go with Luke.
He just pales in comparison, but if that's your opinion, I'll let you go with it. Favorite pro golfer ever and why?
Oh, Tiger Woods. I mean, he's the GOAT. I just love watching him play golf. It's kind of a stereotypical answer, but I just admire everything about Tiger and his work ethic and his obsessiveness. And I always tried to model him. And when I first got into the game, that's why I went with the interlocking grip. I'm like, well, if Tiger and Jack did it, that's the one I'm going with.
The last two great players in the history of the world had the interlocking grip, and I stuck with Ben Hogan's overlap grip. I felt like it was the best, and it got me a coaching job.
Fair enough.
Favorite
Well,
course
me
you have
too.
played? Yeah, same thing. Favorite course you've played?
Favorite course, probably Harbortown. It
Oh,
was
yeah.
I so growing up, like I said, I didn't start actually playing golf until freshman year of high school, but I was always around the game. My family loved the game. I would watch it on TV and Pine. So he always got tickets to the Heritage every year. And so I've been to the Heritage, I believe 24 times. So just about every year I've been alive. And I volunteered at the tournament for 10 years, caddied there in the Pro-Am for about 5 years. And I'd always wanted to play it. So when the day that I finally got to play it, it was like a dream come true.
What'd you shoot? Remember?
The first time I played there, 75. And it's funny because I've always been someone that sprays it off the tee and has a great short game. And so I thought Harbortown was going to be a terrible course for me. And the funny thing is I hit the ball fantastic that day and just putted like a moron.
Bucket list course you'd like to play that you haven't played?
Probably Augusta National. I'm going with a lot of basic golfer answers today, but the other one would be Pebble Beach, another basic answer, but I love the ocean. And so it'd be a tough call between those two, but.
Okay. Perfect. Hole in ones. How many have you made?
Oh, you know, that's a little embarrassing. I'm sitting at zero real hole in ones. So
you've made zero hole in ones. I've only got six more than you,
man. So I mean, I had one on a par three course, but it's kind of an asterisk. It was from 85 yards. I can't really count that. But I'm sitting at zero. I'm blaming the curse of the high ball flight. You know, I hit the high balls that just stop wherever they land. So it's really, really tough to run them in the hole. You know, I've destroyed some.
Well, I have,
and it's bounced out. I've destroyed some cups, but never had one finish at the bottom. So I'm still waiting on the day. I joke about it all the time. The crazy thing is I had never even seen a hole-in-one until last year. I've played so many rounds of golf, and I'd never even witnessed a hole-in-one until last year in a qualifier. One of my Spaniards, Pelayo, made a hole-in-one on the 16th hole. It was a pin with a bank to the right of it. He kind of hit this push fade, and then it just hit the bank and rolled down. He was kind of signed that he hit a terrible shot and gone lucky and went in, but I was thrilled. He signed the ball and gave it to me and said, "Here you go, coach. This is for you." I was thrilled. That was the first one I'd ever seen.
I've got every hole-in-one ball since I've been at Baylor that players have made in my office. So, and one of them was on a 130-yard par three. He did it with a driver just for fun, and the ball went in the hole. That was Luke Morgan. Yeah.
Crazy. Wow. Hey, but I do have two albatrosses. So tell me the odds on that. Two albatrosses and no hole-in-ones.
Wow. Well, I've had no albatrosses, so you got me there. Okay, final question or second to last question. One food you'll never eat, never in a world are you going to eat this food?
I mean, tomatoes. It's not that I'll never eat them because I've tried, but I just do not like tomatoes. I try to get myself to like them. I just can't take it.
Okay.
Can't do
it. I don't know what that's about, but dream foursome, you and three others.
Oh man. Dream foursome, man. I gotta say Tiger Woods, He's always been an idol of mine. So I'm probably going to go with Tiger. And then there's a guy I play golf with all the time back home, Devin. He's one of my best friends. So I'd probably say him, Devin, and my brother, Tyler. You know, I would love to throw my dad in there, but my dad has a pretty bad back. So he struggles to play a bit, but he could just spectate as me, Tyler, and Devin play with Tiger Woods.
Let him drive the car.
Yeah. He can drive the car.
All right. Well, hey, Logan, I really appreciate you spending an hour with me today. You were, incredibly good at answering these questions. And I feel like I know you a whole lot better now in your program. And I think you're doing a great job. Just keep up the good work. And at some point, you're going to get that conference championship. When you do, I want to have you back on the podcast to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much. I was super honored to be here, Coach. I really appreciate you having me, and I appreciate your time over the last couple of years. You've been an incredible resource for me. I've learned so much from you and your book, and I recommend everyone out there to check out your book, Better Than I Found It. It's been a huge resource of mine, and I didn't really know anything when I started coaching, but thanks to you and other coaches at Emmanuel and in our conference, I've been able to piece a couple of things together and get by so far. So thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and I meant to ask you this question I didn't earlier. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received from another coach? You just mentioned it. What would it be?
Oh, best piece of advice. So there's a couple things that come to mind. Honestly, one of them is from you. It's when you said we were talking on the phone and you asked me, you know, what's the most important thing in the world right now? And I didn't really have any idea where you're going with that, but you're saying that the most important thing in the world right now should be this conversation. And that really stuck with me just about being intentional. And so that always comes back to me when I'm talking to recruits. I'm a little bit ADHD. I'm kind of go, 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 go. I get stuff done by like hopping from one thing to another. So it can be really easy for me to be talking to a recruit or talking to one of my guys and trying to do something else or hop to something else. But that intentionality that you said to focus on, I always try to keep that in mind and remember, all right, this conversation is the most important thing in the world right now. I don't need to worry about anything else. And then the one other thing I would say, I asked one of the coaches in our conference that has a top 25 team in the country every year. I asked him for advice on recruiting or, you know, what's his secret to recruiting. He said, there's not a secret. You just got to work your butt off. And so I always think about that. I'm like, all right, there's no secret to finding good players. I just have to work hard. So whenever I'm feeling lazy, I remember those words. There's no secret. I just got to keep grinding.
I agree with that. Totally. He gave you good advice. Well, Logan, best of luck for a great season this year. And let's keep on staying in touch. I've enjoyed our conversations as well. And thanks again for being on today.
Yes, sir. Thanks so much for having me. It was awesome.
You bet.